Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our telephone talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In the first hour of the show today, we'll be talking about one of the most challenging races in the world of sailboat racing. It's a race that begins in Sydney, Australia, and finishes in Hobart, Tasmania. It takes off the day after Christmas. And we'll be talking about one particular race, that is the race of 1998, which was one of the worst, most disastrous races in the recent history of blue water sailing. Of the 115 boats that started the race, just 43 made it to the finish. After a cyclone hit the fleet, 7 yachts were abandoned, 5 sank, 55 people had to be pulled from the water by helicopters and rescuers, 6 sailors were killed. The story is told in a recent book that's titled The Proving Ground, The Inside Story of the 1998 Sydney to Hobart Race. It's published by Little Brown and Company, and the author is Bruce Necht. He's Hong Kong-based foreign correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. He's also written articles that have been published in The Atlantic Monthly, in New York Times Magazine, and in Sail. And he's talking with us this morning by telephone. As we talk with Bruce Necht, you should certainly feel free to call in. Maybe you'll have questions as we continue through the hour. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Also, we have a toll-free line. Good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. So at any point here, if you'd like to call in and join the conversation, you would certainly be welcome to do that. Mr. Necht, hello.
Hi.
Thanks for talking with us today.
My pleasure.
I appreciate it. We should probably set the scene or at least talk a little bit about the place this race takes place, because that is indeed the reason that it is so challenging. What are these waters like?
Well, one of the things that makes the race very challenging is the Bass Strait. The Bass Strait is a body of water that separates the mainland of Australia and Tasmania. Those two bodies of land were once connected, and, you know, hundreds or thousands of years ago when they came apart, it left a body of water that's shallower than the ocean sort of on either side of it. So what happens when you have waves that have been building up over hundreds of miles across the ocean, when they get to that shallow water, they get steeper, they arch their backs, they get taller, in the same way that a beach wave does as it approaches the sand. And the other thing is that it is just an area that's notorious for fast-changing weather conditions. The Sydney to Hobart race, almost every year, it starts the day after Christmas every year, has done so since 1945, and almost every year is marked by a couple of quick, radical weather changes.
So it would be tough anytime, even if you didn't have to deal with a hurricane.
Absolutely. It has a reputation. It's by far not the longest ocean race in the world. It's 630 nautical miles, but it has a reputation of being the toughest in spite of that.
Mm-hmm. At today's speeds, approximately how long does it take to run the course?
It probably takes most boats 3 to 4 days. When the race started, and this is sort of the story of what's happened to sailboats over the years, in 1945 it took the winner won in 6 days, and the others took more like 7. Some took 8. The record holder now is a little more than 2 days. So that's all about the technology of sailboats.
Yeah. Well, that's one of the things that you talk about in the book, the fact that now these boats are very high tech. They're computer designed. They use exotic materials, and all of this is designed to produce a fast boat, which is also, though, going to be a light boat. And if you get really tough conditions, then that's likely to cause you problems.
Yeah, there's a controversy in yachting that's been, I guess, brewing for the last 20 years. And the trade is very simple. If you lighter boats go faster. So the designers have been trading weight for speed, and there are those who think that that's gone on too far, that today's the high-tech racing boats of today will capsize more easily, and also they'll stay capsized longer because they don't have the big full keel that we all know about from just seeing sailboats.
Mm-hmm.
Now they're sort of, you know, fin type keels with a you know, a bit of lead at the bottom, but they're not as heavy as they used to be.
Yeah, the idea of the heavy keel, that is the bottom part of the boat, is even if you got parallel to a big wave and it slapped the boat over on its side, the keel should right it, should get it back right up again.
That's what it's designed to do.
Yeah. But these newer lighter boats, they won't do that?
Well, they do that, but they don't do it as well, and they don't do it as quickly, because they're just simply not as heavy.
Because it seems to me, in reading about the old days of sail, if that happened to you, if you were in a really bad storm and you got parallel to a wave and a big wave came along and laid the boat down on its side, that was it. You were done.
Well, no. You can be knocked down and have your mast in the water, and you're gonna come back upright again. I mean, yeah. In the book, I describe something that's a little bit hard to imagine. I describe how a boat did a 360-degree roll in about 6 seconds. I mean, that is that it went upside down and kept going around the other way in 6 seconds. Now, that happened so quickly that some of the people who were on the boat, who were lying in their bunks, they didn't even fall out of their bunks. They didn't even know that they had done this 360-degree roll that happened so quickly. Mm-hmm. They knew something had happened. It all went dark, and some of them did fall out of their bunks. But it can happen quite fast.
It's really hard. I remember reading that, and it's pretty hard to imagine such a thing, experiencing such a thing.
Well, yeah, it is. I mean, I've sailed all my life. I've never done this kind of sailing, and I had never heard that such a thing was possible. I mean, I was, just as you read it, I was the same way when it was being described to me. I was just wide open mouthed, amazed.
Our guest, maybe just real quick, I'll reintroduce. Our guest is Bruce Nacht. He is a Hong Kong-based foreign correspondent for The Wall Street Journal and is the author of a newly published book that looks at the 1998 Sydney to Hobart race. It's a sailboat race. The title of the book is The Proving Ground, and it's published by Little Brown. And, of course, questions are welcome here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, aside from bragging rights and, I'm sure, some sort of a trophy, what is there in winning this race for the winner?
Well, the first thing that I should say about the race is that it's a race that's unlike any sailing race in the United States, in the sense that everyone in Australia seems to watch it. That's not to say everyone's at Sydney Harbour the day the race starts, but people are glued to their television sets across that huge country, and they follow the race in a way that there's no real parallel, in our country.
So it is it's highly visible, and so the reason that one is in this race and one wants to win this race is at least within the world of sailing, I suppose, that really makes you a superstar.
Yeah, I mean, the book, you might wonder why I called a book about the sea, The Proving Ground. And the reason for that is that, I focus just on three boats, and I tried to, first of all, tell a dramatic story, but I also, one of my goals, which I don't know that I was entirely successful, in fact, I know I wasn't entirely successful, was in trying to get at this great question: why do people do things like this? Why do people choose to use their leisure time to do things that are dangerous, that are difficult? And the answer to the question, to a great extent, and this is how I came up with the title, is that they do it just because it's difficult. They do it because it's challenging. They're looking to prove one thing or another, and the fact that it's the toughest ocean race in the world is precisely the reason why people are drawn to it.
If you decided that you wanted to enter this race and have some hope of winning, what would it cost?
Well, it really depends. I mean, on the high end, one of the three boats I write about belongs to Larry Ellison, the second richest man in the world. His boat, cost $4 million to build. He ships it around the world from race to race. The 23-member crew, almost all of them are professionals. So for him, it was it cost him $10,000 to provide the food for the race. For him, it was, of course, an extraordinarily expensive event. For most people in the race, it's nothing like that. They already own their boat, and they cook their own food. They take care of all their own provisions. Maybe they need a new sail for the race. Maybe they need to get a better life raft. But basically, for them, the costs are not so great, not much more than the cost of doing most of the other races they do all year round.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk a little bit more about the three boats that you write about in detail. And you mentioned the first, Sayonara, which was owned by this guy, Larry Ellison, the founder of Oracle, and a man certainly who had plenty of money. If that's what we're talking about, plenty of money to be able to buy a boat and have a good crew and have the best of everything that money could buy, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, and it's not just a good crew. I mean, his crew included three people who had won both the America's Cup and the Whitbread Around the World race. As far as I can tell, there's about five people in the world who have done both. Who have won both of those races. Most of his crew were from Team New Zealand, the folks that had won the America's Cup. So it was probably, you know, I guess there's probably room to argue about this, but it could well have been the most experienced crew, you know, you could possibly get on any sailboat. So it was an extraordinary group on Sayonara. Mm-hmm.
And you, as you've mentioned, what we have here are people who are intensely competitive. One of the people, interestingly enough, that Larry Ellison was competing against was not only another sailor, but another guy in the software business that had set a record a year or two previous to that, and
yeah,
he was trying.
So Plattner is the guy who started a company called SAP, which is a company that does basically the same thing as Oracle. And Hasso Plattner also is a sailor, and he had won the record for the Sydney to Hobart race in a year that Larry Ellison didn't compete. Ellison had competed in the 95 race, and he had won it. And part of the reason he came back in the 98 race was because he wanted to get that record. He wanted to get it back from Hasso Plattner, an arch rival who he had sailed against, and that sailing had actually changed the whole nature of their relationship to make it a really kind of a bitter relationship. Neither of them will speak to one another. It sort of infused the whole business relationship with a sort of added dimension, which has intensified it to a great degree. So, you know, Larry Ellison is a guy who believes that every moment of every day is part of a great competition to prove just how good he is. I mean, he's the second richest man in the world, and he's unhappy about that. Oracle's the second biggest software company. Microsoft is bigger, Bill Gates is richer, and that makes life for Larry Ellison very unhappy. He believes that you know, the point of life is to see how good he can be in as many things as possible. And that means business, but it also means sailing. It means flying acrobatic planes. It means writing poetry. It means teaching himself how to cook and to play the piano. He believes that it's all one big contest to see, you know, how much he can do in a lifetime.
The next of the three boats that you read about is a boat called the Sword of Orion, which was owned by an Australian, someone who he had never sailed in the Hobart before. Is that right?
No, he had actually done just one Hobart before, the 97 Hobart. His name is Rob Cothey. He at the time was a 54-year-old entrepreneur. He grew up hearing about the race. He was very interested in winning the race for sort of the glory of winning the Hobart, but he didn't have much experience sailing. He bought his first boat just a few months before the 97 race, and he, in the 98 race, was the least experienced sailor on his crew of 10 people. So he was in some ways not very well equipped to be a skipper, and he didn't in some ways appreciate what it takes to have a winning crew. One of the things it takes is managing a boat is actually quite complicated, and one of the keys is to have the same group of people with you race after race, and to have them have the same jobs as they have over and over, but also to give them a chance to communicate with each other, the kind of communicating that you do without even really speaking, sort of understandings about who can do what, who's good at what, who's not good at what. That's what it really takes to run a boat well. And Rob Cothey, because he didn't really have the appreciation for some of that, was probably not so well equipped to run a boat in this kind of extreme weather, which they ran into on the second day of the race.
Yeah, and what he did was he brought two two crew members on right before the race that had not been on the boat before. They didn't know the other members of the crew, and there seemed to be a lot of jostling sort of struggle or competition over just who was running this boat.
Yeah, and that actually began. The problem was the skipper was not someone that many of the other members of the crew had a whole lot of respect for. So the dissension and some of the disagreements about, you know, who was going to be making the big decisions began actually before the race started, before the race started. And that dissension intensified on the second day when the weather got worse, and it became, it became a serious problem for all of them.
Mm-hmm. The third boat that you write about is, interestingly enough, a boat that was in the very first Hobart, and compared is different, at least in the respect that we're talking about these other boats that are, they're very modern, they're high tech, they're computer designed, they're made out of these exotic materials. The Winston Churchill actually was a wooden sailboat.
And that's part of the reason I chose it for the third boat. The Winston Churchill was built in the 1940s. It was named for the former prime minister because it was completed just after the war, and the builder of the boat, who was actually its first owner, wrote a letter and got a response saying that that Churchill himself would be honored to have the boat named after him. The boat competed in not only the first Hobart in 1945, but 17 subsequent Hobarts. It had circumnavigated the world twice. It was one of the best-known boats in all of Australia, and it was one of those sailboats that you don't have to know anything about sailing, and you just sort of see it and just say, you know, gosh, that's a beautiful boat.
Mm-hmm. This is the man who said that what he was going to be doing was gentleman's ocean racing. What exactly does that mean?
Well, Richard Winning is the owner. Comes from an old-line wealthy family from Sydney. His idea, he was competitive. He liked the race because he, you know, liked the sort of man against nature aspects of it. But he recognized that the Winston Churchill, which came in third in that first race when there were just eight boats, was not going to be a contender for one of the top positions in the race. So his idea was that what was important about the race was doing well, but also to do it in a certain style, to do it with old friends and to enjoy the camaraderie of the whole event. Sailing, it's 10 people in a relatively confined space. Camaraderie is one of the great things about sailing. You get to know people quite quickly, and that was a crew that included old friends, one of whom was an investment banker, one of whom was a garbage truck driver. I mean, it was a diversity of mostly middle-aged men, and this was a way they sort of kept connected to one another.
We've talked about what happened, and if people have read anything about the book, they know what happened. Just after the race started, a very big storm came up and hit the fleet and damaged a lot of boats, and some boats were lost. They had meteorologists who were keeping track of the weather to provide that information to the people who were going to be sailing in the race. At what point did those guys who were watching the weather realize that this big storm was headed right for the boats?
Well, 2 days before the race, they knew that there was going to be some difficult weather. In the hours just before the race started, the Weather Bureau put a gale warning in place. But the weather models, you know, the same big supercomputer models that everybody uses, every forecaster uses to predict weather, were in some disagreement about how bad the storm would actually be. About an hour after the race started, two of the models agreed that it was going to be much worse than the gale warning would have indicated. And on the basis of that, an hour after the race started, they put out a storm warning. Now, a storm warning in that part of Australia is the most serious kind of warning there is. They do not have hurricanes in that part of Australia. But that's only because of what it takes, the science of what it takes to create a hurricane. It doesn't mean they don't have hurricane-force winds, which is ultimately what they had. But one of the problems is that the sailors in the race, most of them thought that the storm warning was a lesser warning than the gale warning. They thought a storm warning is what happens on a summer afternoon when you see the dark clouds rolling in. They didn't realize that it was the most serious warning. So for that, the sailors, can be faulted for not knowing something that they clearly should have known.
Mm. Well, certainly, wouldn't the Australian sailors and the New Zealanders, the people who are from that part of the world, have known that?
They should have, but most of them didn't.
Well, so the race started, and then they knew for sure what a bad storm there was.
No, actually, they weren't sure, because the forecast was for weather that was predicted 24 hours out.
So, oh.
First of all, they knew that they had a long gap to make. You know, they didn't have to decide what to do as soon as they heard about the storm warning. Oh. They knew they had some time to decide. They also knew that, you know, as we all do, that forecasts are not a certainty. And some of them, I think, probably had a view that you know, the forecast was probably overstating the severity of the storm.
Well, did I guess one of the questions is, did the people who are sailing in the race have good enough information on which to make the decision, do we keep going or do we try to turn around or do we abandon the race?
On the second day of the race, when the weather really began to worsen, and it steadily worsened from 7 in the morning right through the day, in a stair-step fashion, the wind just kept building and building, and because of the wind, the waves continued to become taller and taller. On the Sword of Orion, Rob Cothey, who I described as someone who wanted to win the race for all the glory it could bring, he wanted to continue racing even while almost everyone else on his crew wanted to quit. Now, it wasn't just because he wanted to win the race that he continued to want to. He wanted to continue racing. He also wanted to find out precisely where the storm was and where it was moving, because he wanted to make sure if they did change their course, they wouldn't go right back into the worst of the storm. Ultimately, he bowed to the pressure of the rest of his crew and agreed to turn around. And it was the worst possible thing to do in the end, because they did go right back into the worst of the storm. So for that, I do fault the Weather Bureau. They could have conveyed more information. They knew more about where the storm was than they conveyed. And so that's what happened on the Sword of Orion, and that led to rather tragic results, because it was an hour after that that the Sword of Orion did that 360-degree roll that I described a little bit earlier, and that led to a 33-year-old Olympic sailor named Glenn Charles being lost from the boat.
Mm-hmm. The organizers, the sponsors of the race, the Cruising Yacht Club of Sydney, they said, and I gather this must be, or perhaps the... I guess I should ask whether it is a policy in the world of sailing for the sponsors, essentially to say to the sailors, it's up to you whether you go or not. It's not up to us to say you should turn around. Is that pretty much the way it is in sailing?
Yeah, the rules of international sailing, it sounds odd to non-sailors, I know. But the idea is, if there's very bad weather at the start of the race, well, then the race organizers are very happy to postpone the start of the race. But once a race starts, the rules of sailing, and this is true of every race around the world, say that the decision as to whether you continue sailing or you abandon the race is up to the individual skippers. Now, there are three basic reasons for that. One is that the skippers are the ones that should know where they are relative to the worst of the weather. So they're the ones that know, at least theoretically, whether turning around would take them away from the storm or put them back in the way of the storm. That's number one. Number two, the skippers are the ones that know what their boats can withstand, what they can take in terms of weather and waves. And number three, they're the ones that know most about their crews and know most about the skill of their crew and the mental sort of attitude of their crew. So the idea is they're the ones that can that are in the best position to make those decisions after racing has begun.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you do, I guess, have to feel in a way for Rob Cothey. It seems like it was a tough call to make. Once, if you're going to decide that you're going to abandon the race, and knowing that there's this really bad weather and not being quite sure where it is, I can imagine the difficulty of that decision, where you ask yourself, well, which way do we go? It sounds like it really would have been a tough call.
It was an extremely tough call, and ultimately what led him to make the decision to go back was really the will of the crew and his recognition, some would say belated recognition, that the crew would feel better even if it was not the best course, but just the sort of notion that they were going someplace else, that they were, you know, attempting to quit the race, to get away from the weather, whether even if it was wrong, would have such a positive impact on their mental state, which at that point was that was a worried crew. None of them had seen, they were at that point in 40-50 foot waves, which is just very hard to imagine. I mean, I think the biggest wave I've ever seen is probably 15 feet, and 15 feet is enormous. 40-50 foot waves are really kind of unthinkable for me.
Well, there, and just for people to visualize it here, with a 50-foot wave, that's you're talking about a 5-story building.
Correct.
There. So maybe that's just one way you can imagine yourself. You can imagine yourself in a boat and being next to a wave that's the height of a 5-story building. And I guess there were some waves that were even bigger than that.
Well, there were helicopter pilots who were involved in the rescue who have radar altimeters, and they, by judging the distance between the peak and troughs of waves, it would seem in a good position to know exactly how high the waves were. And some of those helicopter pilots said that the waves must have been 70, 80 feet high.
Wow. Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Bruce Nacht. He is a writer for the Wall Street Journal. He's a Hong Kong-based foreign correspondent for the Journal. He's also written for other publications, The Atlantic Monthly, Condé Nast Traveler, New York Times Magazine, Sail. And his new book is out just now. It's about the 1998 Sydney to Hobart sailboat race. And the title of the book is The Proving Ground. It's published by Little Brown. And your question's certainly welcome. Someone wants to call in, 333-WYLL, toll-free 800-222-WYLL. I think that you do a pretty good job in the book describing what it must have been like to be out in the storm on these boats. Can you, for people who haven't had the opportunity yet to read it, can you talk a little bit about that and give some idea of just what it must have been like?
Well, the first interview I did on the for the book, even before I decided whether I was going to write it, was with Richard Winning, the owner of the Winston Churchill. And in that first conversation, he described what it was like to look at a wave that he thought was about 60 feet high. Now, this is someone who has sailed all his life. Everyone sort of exaggerates wave heights in races they encounter, but I don't think he's the kind of person who would exaggerate waves. But he described to me what it was like to be at the wheel of his great old vessel and to be looking at this wave and to be sort of plotting his strategy. He knew exactly what he had to do. He had to steer into the wave at something of an angle so that they'd have enough momentum to make it over the top, but not so much that they'd go flying off the other side, because either way, he knew that this was timber construction, and one plank, if it sprung in the course of an impact that was too sudden, would be enough to sink a boat very quickly. He described to me what it was like to be about halfway up the wave when he realized that he wasn't going to make it over the top, that the wave was too big. And he then described how the boat was turned sideways to the wave, and then on its side, and then how the wave kind of threw the boat off the wave and into the trough. He said the impact when they landed at the bottom was as if somebody had taken the boat up to the top of a 5-story building and dropped it.
Hmm. And so the
next person I talked to, John Gibson, was a 65-year-old lawyer who was below at the time. He described what it was like to be below decks when the impact came. He was lying in his bunk. He was thrown across the cabin. He landed with his head hit what he thought was maybe a bolt. There was blood coming down his face. Both of his contacts fell out. And he saw immediately that even without his contacts, that there was water entering the hull quite rapidly. And then he described something that was actually sort of heartbreaking. He described how his first instinct was that he should turn on the engine, because he knew the engine was what drove the bilge pump, and he knew the bilge pump was necessary to evacuate the water. And then he told me that his second instinct was that he better wait until Richard Winning made the decisions, because Richard was the real decision maker on this boat. Richard was at the wheel, but when the boat fell off the wave, he was literally wrapped up in the backstay by a safety harness, a harness that was attached to the deck to keep him from falling off the boat. But as they came off the wave, it wrapped him up in the rigging in a way that his feet were actually suspended off the deck. It took him 6 minutes to get untied from that mess, And by the time he did, he came below. First thing he wanted to do was turn on the engine. Only 6 minutes passed, but it was the 6 minutes, that's how long it took to, for the water to cover the batteries, and as a result, the engine couldn't start. So that's sort of a description of, you know, 6 minutes in the life of the Winston Churchill that hopefully creates a picture of just what it was like.
Yeah, and the Churchill was one of the boats that sank.
It sank very quickly, as a matter of fact. It sank it sank within 60 minutes after they fell off this wave, and at that point, 10 men got into two life rafts where they spent the better part of 28 hours.
Yeah. So they were out on these same waves that we've talked about in life rafts.
Yeah, and life rafts were not so good, I have to add.
So just the technique, if you were trying to sail in weather like this, is, as you describe it, that roughly speaking, that what you try to do is head the boat actually into the wave, go head onto the wave, cup up over the crest, and then essentially surf.
Sort of a sideway, yeah. on the way down, so you don't go straight down, so yeah. You can sort of cushion the impact into the trough, which is going to be, you're not going to be really cushioned. I mean, you see, you know, CNN made a documentary based on the book, which is also called The Proving Ground, and focuses on the same three boats, and there's footage in that of Sayonara, which is Larry Ellison's, boat. It's 80 feet long, and when you realize that this 80-foot boat, when you watch it fall off these waves, it's just enormous. I mean, just the impact. I mean, there's no way to make it gentle, but the point is you try to make it as gentle as possible because all of that impact, in fact, this happened on Sayonara, the impact tends to break things. Things come apart. In the case of Sayonara, the bulkheads, sort of structural members that attach one side of the hull to the other, the bulkheads were actually separating from the hull. And the actual surface of the hull, which in the case of Sayonara was made out of carbon fiber, which is in theory much stronger than the timber of the Winston Churchill, the carbon fiber was going through a process called delamination, which is, I compare it a little bit to what happens with plywood when you get it wet. You know, the surfaces sort of, you know, sometimes bubble up and begin to separate. Well, that's what was happening on Sayonara, and Larry Ellison was watching that. He could see the bubbles, and that's when he realized that carbon fiber, he knew carbon fiber is very strong until it isn't. And when the delamination continues to a particular point, hard to say when it's going to come, it just completely buckles. And the hull would at that point collapse like a paper bag.
Mm-hmm. He finished, not only did he finish the race, he won. Sayonara came in first. Was that a matter of luck? Was it a skill? Was it the fact that they just were far enough away from the worst part of the storm so that they managed to get through?
I think it was mostly the latter. Faster boats go, bigger boats go faster. It was ahead of the worst of the storm. Larry Ellison and the crew didn't know that. But they were ahead of the worst of it, so that's probably the main reason that they avoided, the waves that would have potentially, done them in as well. They won the race, but it didn't feel like winning. I mean, Larry Ellison was, crying and emotional when he got off the boat, and he, he said he would never do the race again. He said the same thing actually after the 95 race, but after the 98 race, I've spent quite a lot of time with him at this stage, and I can say with great confidence that this is not a race he'll ever do again. No one on the boat felt like they had won. By the time they were arriving, by the time they reached Hobart, they had, through the radio, heard what had happened to the rest of the fleet. The initial reports suggested that there might be as many as 20 sailors that had been lost and presumed dead, and which they turned out to be erroneous, but they knew that this race was not about winning long before they reached the dock. Mm.
And we shouldn't, I suppose, undercount what that boat went through. There certainly were times, apparently, during their race when Larry Ellison was wondering, whether they were going to make it or not.
Oh, yeah. I mean, when you see a boat coming apart, as he did, when he saw the bulkheads and the delamination, when he saw that damage, I mean, and he knew how far away they were from land, and he knew that a boat wouldn't reach them before they sunk, and he knew that it would take a long time for a helicopter to reach them. So, I think probably most people, sort of thought through the possible scenarios of everything going horribly wrong.
We talked a little bit about what happened to the Winston Churchill and the Sayonara. What ultimately happened to the Sword of Orion?
Well, the Sword of Orion, after it did its dramatic 360-degree roll, Glyn Charles, the Olympic sailor from Britain, was at the wheel when that happened. He, too, had a safety harness around his chest and a tether that connected the harness to the deck so that he would maintain his position on the boat no matter what happened. Unfortunately, though, the tether burst. It broke during that roll. And so that when the guys who were below deck came above after the roll, they saw Glyn was in the water. Initially, he was 20 to 30 feet away from the boat, but the distance between the boat and Glyn expanded quite rapidly because the boat was being pushed away by 60 mile per hour of wind, and Glyn, with his head just exposed to the air, wasn't really moving any faster than the current. So the two separated quite quickly. The Sword of Orion lost its mast. The engine wouldn't work. There was no way they could bring the boat to Glyn. There was no way they could swim to Glyn. There was no way they could effect a rescue. So that 20 minutes after that, they couldn't even see Glyn anymore, and that's the last anyone saw of him.
Yeah, that must have been a terrible experience for them, knowing that they could see him, that he was there, but
and
they couldn't
was,
get.
They could see that he could see them.
Yeah.
They actually thought, yeah, each of them individually, that Glyn was looking at them. And, although he wasn't speaking, he had obviously been injured when this happened because he could only swim with one arm. They each of them had this thought, and it's a thought that continues to haunt them, is, Glyn, through his eyes, was saying, well, why aren't you coming to get me?
Yeah. That's it's another one of those things that's just really hard to imagine what that would be like, seeing your fellow crew member there, and perhaps also imagining, well, that could be me.
They all had their chance to imagine that long afterwards, because they were rescued by helicopter, some of them, the rescue process didn't go smoothly, not surprisingly, given the conditions. And there were two of the people who were rescued by helicopter who were at various points not attached to the boat, not attached to the cable from the helicopter, just being thrashed by these waves, thinking I'm exactly where Glyn was a couple of hours ago.
Yeah. How difficult was it for the rescuers to determine where the people they were trying to rescue were?
Well, boats have emergency positioning indicating radio beacons, which are called EPIRBs. Now, the problem was that the kind of EPIRBs that they had in the race were the kind that said, I'm in distress, and it sent a signal about where that I was. The problem was that there were so many of these EPIRBs going off, and some of them had become separated from the rafts, some of them separated from boats, so they weren't leading the rescuers to any person. And there were so many EPIRBs going off that caused a lot of confusion for the rescuers. One of the good things that came out of the bad things that happened in the race is a lot of recommendations, and one of those recommendations is that they, in future races, and this has been adopted by races around the world, they should use the kind of EPIRBs that doesn't say, I'm in distress, whoever I might be. It says, I am the Winston Churchill, and I'm in distress. So that after, say, the crew of the Winston Churchill was rescued, you wouldn't have a beacon confusing the rescuers because they would know to disregard that one.
We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus, and I want to introduce our guest again. We're talking with Bruce Nacht. He is a Hong Kong-based foreign correspondent for The Wall Street Journal, a two-time nominee for the Pulitzer Prize. He has been written for a lot of publications in addition to the Journal, and has a book that's been just out a little bit now, officially published on the first of the month, which is about the 1998 Sydney to Hobart sailboat race. And the title of the book is The Proving Ground. It's published by Little Brown in bookstores now, if you want to take a look at it. And again, questions are welcome, 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. Well, in addition to a provision for better emergency beacons that will be on the boats, have other changes been made as a result of the experiences of this 1998 race?
Yeah, I mean, I won't tell you what happened on the Winston Churchill's life raft, but I already did mention that they were sort of falling apart, and they ultimately became more like inner tubes than life rafts. Future races are going to they're required to have much better life rafts. The Weather Bureau, when it issues its forecast, won't be relying on vocabulary like storm warnings to indicate precisely what kind of winds they expect. They'll have the specific numbers in terms of knots. No one under 18 can be in the race. That actually was one of the more controversial decisions. The communications among the fleet and the administrators of the race will be improved. Lots of changes. No one of them will make the race safe or really change in the nature of the race. But I think it is also safe to say that in the sum total of the changes will make a difference, will make racing the Sydney to Hobart as well as other races safer. One thing I probably should have mentioned with the rescue, you know, six people dying in this race is terrible. It's a tragedy. But to me, the fact that the number wasn't higher is almost a miracle. I mean, 55 people came down from helicopters at the end of metal cables and went into these enormous waves and successfully found and brought back up sailors who were in trouble. To me, the idea that that happened 55 times and in each case successfully is something close to a miracle.
Mm-hmm. Well, in addition to mourning the dead, were the rescuers appropriately acknowledged for what they did?
Absolutely. Absolutely. The rescuers, I think it's one of the aspects of what happened that I focused on a lot in the book. I certainly acknowledge them because, you know, they are a very important part of the story. And so I did my best to sort of describe them as people and describe how it is that they came to do that kind of work. And certainly the people who were rescued, I know some of them have become personal friends with the people who rescued them.
You talked about the fact that when after having completed the race and survived the experience, Larry Ellison said, "I'm never going to do this again." But also then you said you've talked enough with him and got to know him well enough to know that, in fact, he most likely will. What about the other people that were in the race, and particularly those members of the crews of these other boats that were lost? Have they sailed again? Will they sail again in this race?
Well, Rob Cothey from the Sword of Orion, he was one of those who was lifted from the Sword of Orion by helicopter. And one day after Glenn Charles was lost, he was flying back to Sydney. On that flight, he was already thinking about his next boat. And one week after that, he invited the surviving members of his crew to his house for dinner. And he, at that time, told them that he had picked out the boat he was going to buy, he was going to get it, he was going to call it the Sword of Orion. He planned on racing in the next Sydney to Hobart race, and he expected everyone from his crew, survivors anyway, to be back with him the next year. In fact, just one of them did. But Rob Cothey did race in that race, and for a while he was actually winning it, although there was, in the 99 race, like in every race, a dramatic change in the weather, which knocked them down to a great extent, and they ended up finishing seventh. But I would say most of the people that I write about are of the view that they'll do the race again.
Hmm. So, and then the former members, the members of the crew of this Sword of Orion that was lost, they just didn't have enough confidence in Cothey to want to sail with him again?
I think that's probably fair in most cases. Some of them also were of the view that they wanted to do it. If they did it again, they wanted to do it on a bigger boat. The Sword of Orion was a bit more than 40 feet, and after their experience, they felt that they would have been better off if they had been on a bigger boat.
Yeah. Would they have been?
I think so. I think so. Bigger boats are in a better position to handle the worst of the weather. Bigger boats have bigger crews, too, which puts them in a better position to react to the extreme conditions. Yeah.
What is the average size of the crew for these boats?
Well, the Winston Churchill and the Sword of Orion each had 10 members. The Sayonara had 23. There's not too many boats that have you know, I'd say most have more than 7 or 8. Most of them probably average around 10.
You would, I think I read in some of the material that came with the book, you're saying that you would like to sail in this race yourself?
Well, it's not the kind of sailing I've ever done or ever really wanted to do. What I'd probably like to do is to do it just once. And I think that's mostly because I've, you know, I spent 2 years, you know, writing the book. I took 10 trips to Australia. I got to, I'm pretty immersed in this race. And I think it would be, you know, from a just a personal standpoint, it would be satisfying to do it just once to see if you know it's as I've described it, as I've imagined it. I don't think though that I'm going to be the kind of person who would want to go back and do it year after year. That's for sure.
So have you done open ocean sailing like this?
I've done just one ocean race. I do a lot of racing, but it's on small boats in relatively sheltered waters. In Hong Kong, I race every Saturday afternoon on a 28-foot boat, but it's in Victoria Harbor, obviously a protected body of water. But I did do one ocean race. We went from Hong Kong to St. John or Shun Juan Island west of Macau, and that qualifies as an ocean race. But the conditions were very calm. It was nothing like the race I've written about in the Proving Ground.
Yeah. Well, I think I have not had the experience of sailing, but I think that I can understand how the appeal, at least, of being out on a nice sunny day when things were relatively calm and the winds were enough to get you where you wanted to go, but we weren't talking about 80-foot waves and 40-50 knot winds. I guess I'm not really quite sure I understand the appeal of wanting to be out in that.
Yep. No, I couldn't agree more. Sailing on a beautiful day, I can think of nothing I'd rather do, but going out and, you know, I mean, the moment-to-moment reality on these boats, and this includes, you know, people. I think a lot of people think the word yacht means someplace luxurious, and you know, they're just sipping martinis or something. I mean, even on Larry Ellison's boat, there was nothing comfortable about it. No one was eating. Nobody was even able to drink. Everyone was seasick. You couldn't sleep. It was absolute misery. I think, you know, if people actually remember what it was like when they're thinking about if they're going to do it again, they wouldn't do it again. But, you know, this is the way I guess we all react to bad experiences. We tend to remember the good parts and remember the sort of, you know, the great sense of satisfaction that we have at the end. And that's what probably drives us to do it, to do something like this again, even if it's not such a great experience when you're actually doing it.
Yeah, and it's the same, I suppose, the same thing that drives people to do, well, whatever it is they do, if it's mountain climbing or deep sea diving or surfing or whatever extreme sport it is that you participate in, it seems to be. So that same thing, and it goes back to, I suppose, the title of the book, this idea of just seeing what it is you're, what kind of challenge you're up to.
Yeah, I mean, you know, people who were, Richard Winning's very successful in business, so was Rob Cothey, so was Larry Ellison, but for one reason or another, it wasn't enough for them. I mean, Richard Winning talks in terms of being part of a generation that had never really been tested in the way that people have had to go off and fight wars and or, you know, provide food for their families when, you know, providing the food required you know, more than holding a job. I mean, he you know, takes it back to sort of the elemental challenges that he thinks that you know, on some level men are supposed to have, but we don't have enough of those challenges anymore.
Yeah. Well, we're going to have to stop there. We've used the time. I want to say, Mr. Necht, thanks very much for talking with us. We appreciate it.
Well, thanks. I've enjoyed it.
Our guest, Bruce Necht, he's Hong Kong-based foreign correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. And if you'd like to read his book, once again, the title is The Proving Ground. It is published by Little Brown.